Well, thanks again for listening to the Park Hills podcast. If you want more information on the things we're doing, go to parkhillschurch.com or the Park Hills Church app. So there's a density to 1 Peter that I don't think people always see, but when you're trying to preach it, that density comes forth pretty obviously.
Yeah, and this one is dense.
Because there's a lot of things in the passages that you can read it in English and make sense of it, but without the Old Testament background, without some other things, you don't see the layers to it.
Right.
But all of a sudden, when you start to pull back some of those layers, you could be stuck for hours. So that's what this podcast is going to be, us stuck for hours talking about. No, that's not true. But we could. We very easily could. And so, you know, there's some interesting allusions here and ideas that clearly come from the Old Testament that we wanted to point out. So take it away, man.
Yeah. And I just quick hit these in the sermon. But this part of the podcast is like being able to talk about these a little bit more.
Yep.
There is such a strong tie here that Peter is trying to make to his believers now, to the believers in the Old Testament.
Yes.
Which, you know, there's a lot of talk about who are his original readers. There's one specific commentary that I've read a couple times. It's a really good commentary. I disagree with this one point, but her point is that Peter's only writing to ethnic Jewish believers.
Right.
And that's why he's using so many of these Old Testament terms. But I think, based on some other evidence in the text, that Peter is specifically writing to more than just ethnic Jews. Mm-hmm. I think ethnic Jews are in that, but he's trying to put these two communities together.
Yep.
And so there's a ton of Old Testament references that maybe the original readers wouldn't have picked up right away, like maybe we wouldn't, but the ethnic Jews in the community would say, like, no, that's us. That's that's the Old Testament people. So,
well, let's pause on that for 1 second, because I think that is a genius thing that we need to notice in 1 Peter. And I noticed this throughout most of the New Testament. This is a little bit of my doctorate work. Like there's a couple of pages that I kind of bring this out. It is not outside the realm of possibility for me, for a faithful Jew, to use these passages as a chance to share the testimony of what their people have been through and how it then applies to the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. That's a different way of saying what you just said, but that's where I'm at. I think most of the time, because people would say, you know, why in the world would Peter use this if he's talking to a mixed audience? There's a lot of reasons why Peter would do this, talking to a mixed audience. And that also assumes that the Gentiles have no backing to the Old Testament whatsoever. They might have known the stories. They might have gone to synagogue a few times. Or they might be so interested in what God is doing that they now have gone back and started just absorbing it.
Right. Right. Well, if Jesus is the culmination of the Old Testament and the whole Old Testament is about him, if you have a Christ-centered hermeneutic, which I'm just going to assume you do.
And you should.
If you do, then you got to think these believers who are coming to faith in Christ, who have no Old Testament background, you've got to think those Old Testament Jewish believers among them are like, listen, you think this is cool? There's this whole prequel, and it's super long, and you should read it because the prequel sets up the Gospels
totally.
So well.
Which I think still happens today. How many times do you—
Except for Star Wars. The prequels did not set
I'm not talking about movies. I'm talking about—
I know. I just wanted to throw that dig on
Star Wars.
That
was a great reference. But I think even today, if you think about it, I know I got this way. I met Christ. I fell in love with Jesus. I fell in love with the idea of him. And then all of a sudden, a couple of years in, I start reading the Old Testament because I was told to, and stuff started coming to life for me that I never noticed before. And I'm going, holy cow, this gives so much more depth to Jesus and so much more amazing ideas. And I'm even more down the road now going, everyone should know the Old Testament.
Right, right.
So go ahead with your thought.
Well, I mean, the common like thing that you hear in seminary is every professor tells the story but doesn't actually do it, of the one professor who gets his group of students and says, everybody take out paper and pen, and they do. And then he holds a Bible up in front of them and he rips the Old Testament away from the New Testament and throws the Old Testament in the trash and says, this is how most of you treat your Bible. Why is it, why would this be a problem? And then they all have to write a paper. And then at the end of the semester of teaching the Old Testament, he says, hey, remember that paper you wrote? I want you to rewrite it. It's that type of thing. Like, there is so much in the Old Testament. When you start reading about the temple and the sacrificial system and the people of God and the exile and all that kind of stuff, it brings so much of that to light. So that's what I think Peter's really trying to do here, is he's trying to take these Old Testament and New Testament people and glue them together.
Yes.
And say, hey, this is the same thing. And there's some really interesting things. So this happens a lot in this passage. First, verse 13, the ESV translates, prepare your minds for actions. It works because it means something to us, but that is literally gird your loins. That's Exodus 12.
It's Exodus 12. It's Elijah.
It's Job.
Yeah, it's Job. I mean, there's so many passages in the Old Testament where that phrase is used.
Yeah, just the idea of like prepare yourself. You know, so here it says, prepare your minds for action. It's literally, it's gird the loins of your mind. Like, today it'd be like, put on your running shoes. Mm-hmm. Like, get your workout clothes on. We're going to go do something. Mm-hmm. Like, verse 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in your conduct. For it is written, that's Leviticus. That's a quote of Leviticus.
Yep. Which is everyone's favorite book.
Yes. Yes. And if you call on him as Father, the Father is calling God Father. That's very much an Old Testament concept that, and they would have said, you know, God is our Father and Israel is the Son. And now it's like, oh no, Jesus is the Son. Oh, that's a little bit different. He acknowledges the exile in verse 17. He says, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile. Verse 19 has references to blood and to the sacrificial lamb. Most likely this is Passover. Mm-hmm. So he's connecting them with the Passover. Now imagine you are a Gentile Christian. To you, the Passover means nothing. You've never studied it. You know, it's kind of like now, people will say like, oh, Americans don't know any history besides America, and then maybe Europe. And it's like, oh, that's true, and maybe there are some things that need to be fixed in the system, but also it makes sense that American kids mostly know American history, like the history of other countries that we don't belong to. Yeah. And so it's similarly, like they probably don't know Jewish history where the Jews, like the Passover is so important to them. Mm-hmm. I remember I was having a conversation in a public park with a Jewish guy. We just started talking about spiritual stuff. And his closing question to me was, he's like, well, you know, I'm talking about Christianity. He's talking about being Jewish, very nominal Jewish. But anyway, he's like, well, I just got to know, what do you think about Moses? As the greatest Old Testament prophet. He's like, oh, okay. Because to him, even in his nominal Judaism, the Passover and Moses was foundational. And then you have these Gentile who are seeing this, and they're like, well, what's the Passover? A lamb without blemish or spot? The precious blood of Christ? What is that? Oh, can you just imagine the conversation? Let me tell you about what happened in our history and how Jesus becomes this ultimate Passover lamb. So cool.
So why wouldn't the early church have done it that way? Do you know what I'm saying? So like when I hear
But
I'm saying when I hear the argument of people like, Peter would never do that to an audience that's mixed, I disagree completely.
Man, I think he totally would.
Because I think even when we're preaching, there are moments where, okay, let me just use a really simple example. The people who have taken my class for my doctorate are coming up to me after the sermon and going, I heard that comment. I heard this comment. I heard that. And they're hearing things in a new, fresh way that they would have never heard before. The angels looking into things in the last podcast, they come up to me with verses like that. They're, oh my goodness, I think I know what that's talking about. I'm like, no, I don't know that any of us really fully do, but they're more interested in it because of where I took them with this class. So I think we do this all the time without realizing it. You're talking to a mixed audience. You're going to use things that are going to impact both people in different ways.
Yeah.
And you're going to expect them to share with their brother or sister, this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm experiencing.
Yeah, and it's good stuff. And in a new community that's reading this together, like, man, you got to think they're going to discuss this.
Totally.
And then the last one is the term futile in verse 18, knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited. Futile is used over and over again that same term in the Greek translation of the Old Testament for idols, like 1 Kings 16:2, Hosea 5:11. There's others. There's this connection of Old Testament Israel being set apart from the nations, but now these nations are a part of the family of God, and Peter's bringing them together. And I think one of them that's cool and let's dive deeper into is this idea of being holy. Verse 15, as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Since it is written, you shall be holy for I am holy. That's a quote of Leviticus. Chris, unpack that for us.
Yeah. So holiness, I think the easiest way for me to explain holiness, and I know we've done this on the podcast before, but I'll do it again here. I think the easiest way to understand holiness is to think about the opposite of what holiness is. So when I talk about holy, people sometimes think the opposite of holy is evil or disgusting. No, the opposite of holy is common.
Yeah.
It's just the things that you do every day. What makes something holy is being so set apart, it is so different that you start to notice how different it is. And so the reason why this verse in Leviticus is used, when God says, you shall be holy for I am holy, he has just said to his people a couple of verses before in Exodus, I have bought you. I purchased you from slavery. You are now to be different. You're going to move to a land that you don't know. The people don't know you either. They all have ways of living. They have things that are common. This is just who they are. They worship idols. They have feudal ways of living. That's why that verse is used.
Yeah.
They have all these things that they're doing that are just really normal for them. And you're going to move into town and you're going to want to be normal like them. You're not them. Yeah. You're mine. I bought you. And because I am different than they are, you now are going to be different as well.
Yeah, and a good illustration of that is just in the utensils that they were to use. Some utensils were holy and some utensils were common. It wasn't that. I have heard the category profane, like holy, common, and profane. And, and there's certainly things that are profane in those categories. But yeah, you think about like, okay, I have this pot and this is a common pot, which is used for common uses. But this pot is special. And is set apart, it's holy, it's different, and we're only going to use it for these certain uses, like the temple, for example. So that doesn't make the common one morally bad. That doesn't make the common one trash, or this is, how could you touch that pot? It's just, no, that's for common, everyday, normal, nothing special type of use. But this one's for something special. It's a special use pot that we're only going to pull out, you know, when we're in the temple. And now God has done that with the whole nation. Like this whole nation, I've got a special job for you. You are to be special to me, set apart, called out, and different. And then that part of what he calls them to be different then is to influence the nations.
Totally with you. And I totally agree too, the holy, common, and profane. The reason why I love using the holy versus common idea is it even separates in your mind what you're trying to aim for. Because I think if we just said there's holy and profane, most of us would look around at our life and go, I don't really have a lot of profane anymore, so I'm good.
Yeah.
But what God's calling you to is something that you can't do on your own.
Yeah.
The holiness that he's asking for, I am holy, so therefore you should be holy, is you need to trust me to do everything. And really this entire passage in 1 Peter 1, that is the point. You can't save yourself. You can't get the inheritance you deserve. You can't become a part of the family. You can't set your minds to action. You can't gird your loins. You can't. There's nothing you can do to really accomplish this. You need to understand that I am the only one who's going to guide you and lead you in this. Now, because I've done that and I've made you holy, don't live in the ways of ignorance that you did before. Right. And your lives might look and feel profane. They shouldn't anymore.
Right.
But even the common aspects of your life aren't common anymore. You are holy. You're different. Now, the problem that we have with this, when we start to break down holiness a little bit, is a lot of Christians hear that, and then their next move is, well, then I'm going to separate myself from everyone.
Yeah.
Which isn't what holiness is calling them toward. Like even with the illustration that I'm giving, which is what Peter's referencing here, When God says to his people, you shall be holy for I am holy, again, that is them moving into the promised land. And in the promised land, at the time that they're about to move in, there are giants there. There are people who are worshiping other gods. There are you know, incestuous relationships are normal. There's so much grossness going on. And what God is saying is when you move into town, you're not going to be this way anymore, which is why, you know, I'm reading through the Bible in a year with a few people again, do this every once in a while. And we just got through parts of Numbers and Joshua and, you know, I'm in Judges right now. So much of the book is really disappointing. So the way that the Israelites just decide to live like the people around them, you know, the Moabites in Numbers come to town and there's some kind of disgusting festival ritual that's occurring and it's really, really messed up. And I think we just don't think about the fact that what you are called to is you are called to be different. By the power of Christ inside of you now, you're called to live different. But that doesn't mean to live outside of. It means to live amongst, but be so different. And I think where I get passionate about this is I want Christians who are so committed to Christ that evil could be occurring around you and you're not taking part.
Mm-hmm. But you're still there. Like, not in the sense that you're, like, participating, like you're saying.
Definitely not participating. Maybe not even putting yourself in those positions, but if it was occurring around you, you're able to hold your own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yeah, and I think there's a temptation to read this set-apart language and then become, I'll use the term cloistered, become so cloistered that we never have any impact or influence in our world. We're so separate from them. We no longer participate in that community that then we lose any opportunity to have influence on our world through personal relationships because we're so separate from them. We can't be around them and we can't be around anyone who is also around them.
Right. And I think about the old monastic traditions. They still exist, some of them, but less and less people take part in them. But separating oneself for a period of time might be necessary. There might be a reason for a period of time for you to break a habit or break something else out. I totally understand that. I'm not, you know, denying that fact. I'm not telling you should never do something like that. You know, you and I have at different points in our life taken many retreats to let God speak or to let God do something incredible in our lives. That's totally fine. But my point is there are people that sometimes they come to Christ and then their move is, I'm going to move out in the country. I'm going to never talk to anyone again. I'm going to show up at church. I'm going to serve a little bit here and there, but I'm going to be all about God all the time.
Yeah.
I would love it if you were all about God all the time and one with your neighbors.
Yeah.
Sharing that message of Christ with, even if your neighbors think you're crazy, which I think mine all do. You know, I bumped into someone just yesterday who asked me a really challenging question about something that because they know I'm a pastor. I'm not really sure where they're at with their faith. And they said something to me like, well, I know that you don't like this thing. I'm not going to go into detail because it'll tell the person will know exactly what I'm talking about. And I looked at them and I said, I actually don't have an opinion on that thing. All I want is I want you to follow Jesus and I want you to walk with Jesus all your life. And they're like, okay. And they walked away. And I'm going, that I think is what it looks like to live amongst and be holy as I am holy, right? This idea of like looking at God saying, he has changed me so much. I can hold my own. I'm not afraid of having hard conversations. I'm not afraid of pushing people's buttons. I'm not afraid of leading them to Christ, even if they don't accept that moment where they're pushing back because they go, oh, here he goes again with the Jesus talk. I'd rather be known for that than be known for the guy who's hiding in the country because he's afraid of people finding out.
And I think like it doesn't just happen geographically, but in the communities we're willing to participate in, like we call this separation, right?
Yep.
And I was telling Chris, beforehand about this class I took that talks about, you know, one of the biggest differences as you look at greater theological movements in our country, one of the biggest distinguishers between what we today would call fundamentalism and evangelicalism, those terms as used in 2024, because I think those terms used in 1954 is a lot different.
Different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
But one of the biggest thing is this idea of separation, or a lot of them would even include the idea of secondary separation. So I pulled up a school, I won't mention the name of school, but it's a Bible college, that this is in their doctrinal statement. So their doctrinal statement includes things like the scriptures, the Trinity, the person of Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit, creation, you know, on and on and on, all the things you would expect. But then there is an article in their statement of faith, which means that this is of the highest importance to them. If you do not agree with this, you do not fit at all with this school. It says, we believe that the Bible commands separation from all forms of religious liberalism, apostasy, and doctrinal compromise, as well as separation from disobedient brethren who choose to tolerate or condone liberalism and compromise rather than separating from it. Hmm. Which sounds, on the surface level, sounds nice. Like, yeah, we don't want to be tainted by liberalism, apostasy, and doctrinal compromise. But in practice, and the name of this article of their faith is separation, in practice, what that means is anyone that you don't agree with, you declare them an apostate.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that you don't agree with, everything about them, you gotta get rid of them. And where I saw this one time, I went to Cedarville University for my undergrad. One of my professors was invited to speak at a school that practices secondary separation, and he was invited to speak at a public college mm-hmm. at their, or maybe it was even a Christian, but nominally Christian, you know.
Like a Baylor.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like, Baylor's a Baptist school, but they do not act like Baptists, yeah.
And so as an academic, he's like, yeah, my academic reach is in both of these communities. So he spoke at the first one. And then when the second one found out that he would associate with this other school, they disinvited him. And they're like, you are no longer allowed to speak at our school. And he's like, why? He's like, because you would go into that other place. And he's like, I am presenting information. Like, I am speaking to them. And they're like, nope, we practice secondary separation. And this is where I think that holiness clause, like as evangelicals and in the Evangelical Free Church and myself personally and you as well, mm-hmm. we very clearly do not practice secondary separation. Like
correct.
We are not going to participate in those things, but that doesn't mean we're never going to be around those people mm-hmm. or we're going to condemn all the people who don't follow the same thing. I think they might say, well, it's only we're separating from disobedient brethren, you know, anyone who claims Christ but not. But I see this, it goes a lot farther than that.
It usually goes a lot farther than that, and it creates problems. If you just stop and think about the fact that we are to be witnesses to the world, right? Let's go back to this, be holy for I am holy. Let's go back to the idea of, you know, you were once living in a feudal way. How in the world would you reach people in your former ways to Christ if you never see them again?
Yeah.
So that's just not the place to be. And back to what I think you're making a really good case for what I'm trying to say. What I want are Christians who are so committed to their faith and so confident in their walk with Christ that they are not afraid to step into any arena and they're going to hold their own. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily arguing your faith. It just means I could go into a space that is very uncomfortable for some people and live for Christ in that space to reach people for Christ. I don't know if this goes along with what you're saying, but I had tell me if it makes sense. But years ago, I was talking to a college student, and he was a former Catholic who now was extremely reformed, like fundamentally reformed, to the point where I did not check most of the boxes for him. But he sensed that I loved God so much that he was willing to just let me be me.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of I felt like he was capitulating just to talk to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, felt like he wanted to separate from me, but he was trying to feel this whole thing out. And what I said to him at one point was, what if God called you to singlehood and you were supposed to become a priest and go back into the Catholic Church to preach the good news to the Catholic Church? Would you do it? He's like, I would never do that in my life. I'm like, right, that's a dangerous place. He's like, why would God ever want that? I'm like, why would God not want his church to reform? Why would he not want his church to wake up to what it's supposed to be doing? And little did he realize what I was doing was telling him basically what Martin Luther had done and asking if he would ever do that. And now Martin Luther didn't go back into the Catholic Church. He was a part of it and asked it to reform. But he was Lutheran in much of his theology, and yet he wanted nothing to do with that idea. And I'm going, it's such a dangerous place to be, because he was a guy that was struggling whether I'm supposed to be single forever. He hadn't dated anybody. He was passionate about Jesus. And I'm like, what if God made you single to do something incredible like that? And he's like, God would never call me to do that. I'm like, I just don't know that he wouldn't. at the same time, I didn't know that he would. I'm asking the question of, like, I want believers who are so firm in their faith, not that they'll never falter, not that they'll never doubt, not that they'll never struggle, but more the fact that they would look at Christ and say, you're so worth it, I will go live amongst the world, not of the world.
Yeah.
But even if my friends around me began to take me down a road that they shouldn't go, I'm able to stand my own and say, I don't really participate in that. I don't do that. And not because I'm holier than thou, not because I'm a fundamentalist or whatever. I'm committed to Christ. I'm doing my thing.
Yeah.